lead us through Habitat. I made sure not to put it on the final day or at the end of a day. So it's your chance to shine, Dave.
Yeah, I was really pleased that I had so much time. Now I'm looking at the clock and much of it seems to have disappeared. Okay, this is the report of the Habitat Committee. Since the last meeting of the council, there's been a meeting of the plan development team and also a two-day meeting and a two-day meeting of the combined committee advisory panel and plan development team. And we are now at the position where we're going to be launching off in a new direction. And I'd like to just recap a little bit so that we are all on the same page. What we're doing is the Essential Fish Habitat Omnibus Amendment 2. The whole thing began in 96 with the Sustainable Fisheries Act, the 96 reauthorization of Magnuson, which required the protection of essential fish habitat, which is our current mandate. In 98 was the first EFH omnibus amendment, and now what we're doing is Omnibus Amendment 2. The purpose of Omnibus Amendment 2, what it will do is, it's going to be joined to a number of other fishery management plans, or direct fishery management plans. In particular, it will become a part of the groundfish plan, the scallop plan, the monkfish plan, the herring, the skate, the Atlantic salmon, and the deep sea red crab plan. The legal mandate, really there's three parts to it, and the wording of the legal mandate has dictated a lot of what we've done since in ways that may not be readily apparent. The first mandate was to describe and identify essential fish habitat for each fishery. The second mandate was to minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects of such habitat on such habitat caused by fishing. There was also a third section that said to identify other actions to encourage the conservation and enhancements of such habitat. But basically, the mandate breaks down into those two first functions: describe and identify EFH, and minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects on such habitat caused by fishing. Essential fish habitat was further defined in the Act as being those waters and substrates necessary to fish for spawning, breeding, feeding, or growth to maturity. It further went on to define substrate as being sediment, hard bottom, structures underlying the waters, and associated biological communities. Because of the two parts of it, of the mandate, the omnibus amendment was originally divided, this is going back now about 4 years, into two phases. And this is for people who weren't part of the council then, or people in the audience who may not be familiar with why we did this. Because of the double nature, of the binary nature, I should say, of the legal mandate, it was divided into two phases. The first phase was the designation of EFH, essential fish habitat, and HEPCs, habitat areas of particular concern. This was done some time ago, and while it's not a finished done deal, alterations can still be made. That part of the amendment has been completed. Phase two is the minimization of fishing impacts on essential fish habitats. The question then becomes, how do you do that? How do you evaluate, first of all, and compare fishing impacts? So over 3 years ago, the decision was made to develop a tool, a metric that could be used to make these kinds of determinations. And the result of that was the so-called SASE model that we've been working on now for about 3 years. The SASE model started out fairly small compared with what it evolved to. And it has become a much bigger sort of a tool, a much more extensive tool than we had originally planned. The tool will have widespread application, not just for the New England Council, and it is now a finished, completed plan. It's operational. It's gone through its reviews. It's gone through its peer review, and it is now operational. As with all plans, the best plan operates on simple premises, and it was Linus Pauling, double Nobel Prize winner, once said that it should be the duty of every scientist to explain what it is he does in terms that can be understood by the reasonably well-educated and reasonably intelligent individual. And if he can't do that, then he's probably not working on anything very important. And looking at the SASE model, the questions that I get about it indicate to me that most people don't understand just how simple the basic concept of the plan is. When you look at the whole thing, it looks extraordinarily complex, but it really isn't. The data crunching, what goes into it, may be complex. There are a couple of really neat mathematical tools that these people that designed it came up with that are just mind-bogglingly elegant the way they're done, the mathematical expressions. But the tool is based upon a very simple premise, and that is that we need a common means of comparing the effect of gear types across all gear types on the bottom. And its starting point is to convert all fishing effort into area swept on the bottom, because, as I mentioned before, the substrate is basically the most important part of this, according to the legal mandate. So what we do is we take all of the fishing effort within grid cells and convert it to area swept. Now, the area swept may be a portion of that grid cell. It may be far more than that grid cell. If you sweep a whole grid cell twice, then it's twice the area. If you sweep it once during the year, then it's a very small part of the area. But that can be put together on the known fishing effort to give you a total number that you begin with, which is the kilometer squared of gears of area swept. The next thing you do is you adjust this downward, and there are three steps to adjusting it downward. This is because not all areas have the same susceptibility to disruption, and not all gear types disrupt equally. So the first adjustment downward is to account for the reduced contact that some gear types have with the seabed. So some gear may sweep a large area, but not much of the gear contacts the bottom. Other gear types may sweep less of the area, but all of it contacts the bottom. So the first thing you do is you adjust down within each gear type for the value of the reduced contact from that particular gear type. The third thing you do is you put in a metric for the susceptibility of the particular type of bottom. Not all bottom is equal on a susceptibility basis. So you have a metric that simply takes the first step is to reduce the area swept by the contact index for the gear. The second thing is to reduce it based upon your susceptibility input for that particular kind of bottom. And then the final thing you do is you have to have some way of adjusting for the recovery of the area. This is one of those places where the mathematicians that did this just did something that never would have occurred to me. They took a decay function because the mathematical decay function, very straightforward, not simple math, but straightforward, recognizing that there's a similarity between decay and the recovery of an area. So you take a decay function for that area, and you reduce the swept area by that amount. And what that does is it gives you a final figure for what the effect is on that piece of bottom. And what do you do with that? There are two things you want to know. One thing you want to know is the vulnerability of that particular type of area, and the second thing you want to know is how much of it is swept by actual fishing gear not theoretical, but by actual fishing gear over the space of the year. So you have two runs of your model. One is called a simulation run, or the simulated run, rather, the simulated model run. What you do with this is you take all of your squares, all of your known squares, and you run the model with the same amount of impact, square by square, the same amount of area, rather, square by square, over a period of years. And you run it until it reaches an equilibrium. That equilibrium tells you what the susceptibility of that bottom is. And that's the first thing. The second one is what you call a realized model run, and that's when you take the actual input of fishing gear on that area to give you the real-time data, so to speak. And that's really basically all there is to it. And I wanted to go through that because some of the questions that I'm getting indicate that people don't really understand how elegantly simple this model is. There's an awful lot of data in it, but that's really basically all it is. It takes area swept and reduces it by various factors to account for real-life situations. So having said that, I'm going to turn this over to Michelle to tell us about where we stand. By the way, SASE, anybody who has any further questions on SASE, Michelle's available. She's also put together, it was in the material that you were given today, frequently asked questions about the SASE model. And I would encourage anybody with questions about it to look at that first and then contact Michelle about anything else. And I see Chad is back there, and if I've misrepresented anything, Chad, you can correct me.
Thanks, Dave. So I just wanted to briefly put a couple of my thoughts about where we're going with this process before the council and then just go through the committee's motions from our last meeting that were basically tasking the plan development team for the next couple of months or so in preparation for hopefully having a full set of alternatives to include in the Phase 2 EIS for you guys to approve in June. So Dave went through these. This first slide is just the Magnuson-Stevens Act language on essential fish habitat. Obviously, the first bullet refers to what we did in Phase 1. The second is what we're trying to do right now, minimize to the extent practicable adverse effects. And how what we're doing now is a little bit different from what we've done in the past is that the goal is to be integrated across plans and to kind of compare the magnitudes of adverse effects from our different fisheries and fishing gear types. and figure out the best way to optimize the strategy across all of our FMPs. And then just to make a point on the third, identifying other actions to encourage conservation and enhancement of habitat, a lot of the things that could be done really aren't within the purview of the council. I think that perhaps more appropriately relates to the consultation ability that we have under EFH, and that is something we largely delegate to the service. So here's just some more language from the final rule, and I'm not going to go into this in any detail, and you've all seen this before, but the swept area seabed impact model was really designed to be able to answer these questions. The first one that gets towards looking at the effects of fishing under our FMPs, under other federal FMPs, just to point out, in the SASE model, we are modeling all bottom-tending gear types in the region, so we're kind of considering activities that are occurring that are managed by the Mid-Atlantic Council, and also we have lobster gear in the model. So we're kind of taking a holistic look. And we do consider these effects on different types of habitat, as I think Dave was explaining, and that's all detailed in all the SASE documents. And obviously, if you have questions, please let me know. And then the final point on this slide is about cumulative effects. And one of the nice things about the SASE model is because everything is in these area swept units and we can compare the relative effects of fishing with different gear types and consider them in a cumulative way. So basically there's three things that we're doing with the model. The first thing is the simulation runs that Dave was referring to. what we're trying to get out of those runs is, independent of the actual density of fishing effort, which locations of the seabed on the continental shelf are relatively more or less vulnerable to fishing, and that's gear type by gear type. So that's kind of the first cut of the analysis. And then something else we can do with the model when we bring in this actual area swept data and convert it all to kilometers squared, we can look at what our current magnitude of adverse effect is across fisheries and different gear types. And then finally, we can use SASI as a predictive tool, assuming that we're making some assumptions in that case about where fishing effort would shift to in, you know, in response to a given management action or whatever. But it can be used in that way. I just a little bit of a food for thought going forward here. I think in the past we've had these habitat closed areas, and that's been appropriate because they've been designated within plans. So we had habitat closed areas in Amendment 13 and also to scallop gear in Amendment 10 to the scallop plan. I think maybe gear-restricted areas is going to be a more useful way for us to think about it going forward because in reality all of our habitat closed areas do have some types of fishing gears that occur there. So maybe if we are kind of thinking about within an area that is vulnerable for whatever, the habitat's vulnerable for whatever reason, then we can think about which gear types it might be appropriate to restrict and how those restrictions might happen. And just to point out that as we do these analyses, we're going to need to make some assumptions about different types of fishing gears that can or cannot fish on certain bottoms, and that may have implications for the kind of alternatives we develop. For example, if you consider a raised foot rope trawl, we make the assumption in the model that it can't fish on cobble or boulder bottom. So if you have an area of the seabed that your concern is the vulnerability of cobble and boulder bottom, putting a restriction on raised foot rope gear might not be necessary because we make the assumption that that gear isn't going to impact those bottoms. So those are just kind of some things to think about as we're moving forward. And then just another point, one of the original goals of the omnibus amendment was to look at what the habitat-related research and information needs are, and also to include a consideration of dedicated habitat research areas. And so that's something that the committee has expressed interest in, and the PDT and the committee are going to be moving forward in the next couple of months. And so, you know, obviously that's going to be a second cut once we look at how any spatially specific habitat-related management might change, then the next step would be to consider which areas within those areas, within either newly open to fishing gear areas or newly restricted areas, might be appropriate as a gear restricted or a research area. Excuse me. So just to get on to the motions, all of them, not all of them, many of them relate. Have language in them to do something in relation to the goals of the amendment, so I figured it would just make sense to put up these original goals that we had back when we started this process too many years ago to really think about. So briefly, updating EFH designations, identifying fishing and non-fishing threats, prey species information, those were all done in phase one. And then these are kind of paraphrased from the original language just to keep them shorter. But what we're trying to do now, identify mechanisms to protect EFH, define some thresholds for knowing when we've minimized adverse effects to an adequate degree, integrating our measures across our plans, and then finally updating the research and information needs. So that's kind of what we set out to do with this amendment. So the committee's first motion was to evaluate the appropriateness of the current boundaries of the closed areas in obtaining the goals of the amendment using the SASI model simulation runs. So those are the ones that are independent of the density of actual fishing effort and just show you the underlying vulnerability of the seabed. And this was intended to be with respect to all of the different gear types that are modeled and to look at our habitat EFH closures, also look at how the year-round groundfish closed areas are at encompassing vulnerable habitat. Look at the gear-restricted areas. The two are basically the inshore Gulf of Maine and then also when fishing on a monkfish day at sea, there's some gear restrictions in the southern management area. And so the question we'd be trying to address here is, do those areas encompass vulnerable EFH relative to other areas in their region? And we'd be dividing up regions by Gulf of Maine, Georges Bank, Southern New England, Mid-Atlantic Bight together, and then kind of an offshore, deeper water. So I don't know if anybody, if we want to, Dave, take any comments or questions now, or just wait until we go through the entire. Okay. So, if anybody has.
Are there any specific questions based on what's been presented thus far? Okay.
Yeah, I'll just keep going, and then we can wait till the end. All right. Thanks, John. Okay, so the second motion is very similar. Basically, given the analysis of the current closures and just in general which areas are more or less vulnerable to fishing, just provide the committee with some suggestive modifications of boundaries or new areas or elimination of existing areas that aren't meeting our goals to minimize the effects of fishing on EFH. So motions 3 and 4 were very similar to the first two, but rather with respect to HAPCs, habitat areas of particular concern, which are a subset of EFH that meet some criteria, which are actually on the next slide if you want to flip ahead. And so I think the goals for HAPCs may be slightly different than the goals for a gear-restricted area. And maybe this is something that we want to talk about a little bit, but the one way to view HAPCs is as a tool for focusing the councils or in particular other outside groups' attention on those areas. For example, if the Fishery Service was doing an EFH consultation with another group that was interested in doing something extractive in an HAPC, because it's an HAPC, it might receive kind of greater scrutiny in that process. So that's kind of one way to think about HAPCs as being a way to bring focus to an area. And so, you know, given that the goals are slightly different for those areas, we'd basically be looking at our existing HAPCs and then the ones that were proposed in the first phase of the amendment. And I can provide information about those to anybody if they'd like. It needs their memory to be jogged a bit. And then, in addition, look at any additional HAPCs that might also meet the goals or better meet the goals of what we're trying to do. And then these are just the criteria for HAPCs, which are defined in the EFH final rule, fairly straightforward. Ecological function, sensitivity to anthropogenic stress, extent of current or future development stress, which I think is intended to mean mostly non-fishing, but somebody can correct me if I'm off there. And then also the rarity of the habitat type. So something else that we talked about at the joint habitat meeting was once we have this suite of areas that are more or less vulnerable to fishing that we would want to focus our management measures on, how do we determine if those areas are practicable for taking action? And so one way that will be relatively straightforward to do, given the way that the data have been organized already for the SASE model analysis, would be to look at the relationship between the value of the landings coming out of a given SASE model grid cell and compare that to the adverse effects associated with that amount of fishing effort. So we can start to get an idea of areas of the model domain where there's very high value and also high or moderately high adverse effects and consider those areas in one way. We might have different thoughts about areas that have high adverse effects but relatively low value. And so it kind of this kind of value to adverse effects relationship would give us some sense for how to make trade-offs in determining which measures might be practicable as we move forward. And just to point out that the revenue data is aggregated at the TRIP level, so I mean, in some cases, if you were talking about scallop gear, it's pretty clear that, you know, that revenue is mostly coming from one species. Obviously, for other gear types, you've got more of a mix of species. So this analysis would really be at the gear type trip level. So we'd have a sense for which species we were talking about, but it wouldn't be precisely telling you value by species. That would require kind of quite a bit more data processing to get us to that point. And then the committee's final motion was just to provide, that the PDT provide them a list of potential appropriate sites to protect deep sea corals. And if you remember back from phase one, there was a lot of this same coral data that we're working with now is basically a presence of coral data that was collected on, you know, various different kinds of research surveys. Some of it's older, some of it's much more recent. That data was also used in the HAPC designation and evaluation process in many cases. So just some things to consider is the coral distributions are basically points depending on how the surveys were done. And obviously you'd need to make some inferences about the extent of the coral area around those. And so we're going to need to do some work to determine which assumptions we want to make there. And there's basically two different kinds of authorities under which the council can take action on deep sea corals. There's the discretionary or the 303B authority, and that's only been in Magnuson since it was most recently reauthorized. Or the council could take action under the essential fish habitat authority, because corals are organisms that provide structure for our managed species. You would essentially be saying that you want to protect the corals because they provide structure, and the adverse effects of fishing on them you think are problematic, and you're essentially maintaining that structural habitat for the managed species in question. And that kind of strategy was done when the Lydonia and Oceanographers Canyons were closed to fishing on a monkfish day at sea, if anyone remembers that action, how that went. So that was the EFH authority. Or you could, you know, certainly call an area designated under both authorities, I would assume. And the one of the main differences that I noticed, I think the 303B authority, the consultation implications are a little bit different. If it's designated under EFH, then the service is going to be able to consult with groups that might want to do other things in those deep sea coral areas because the areas are designated EFH. And then something else to think about is that we, in many of these areas, have HAPC designations that have already been approved by the council back in 2007, but not implemented yet. And so you might designate a site under 303B and then maintain the HAPC designation concurrently for consultation purposes or something. And then something else to think about, I guess, with regards to corals is that many of these, in particular in the down along the Mid-Atlantic Bight canyon areas, are in areas that have fisheries that are managed by the Mid-Atlantic Council and the ASMFC. There may be some we'll definitely be cooperating with them as we move forward on these types of measures. And just to kind of, I guess, generally point out something that the SASE analysis is going to show, but that we haven't really documented yet for the council that you've seen, is that overall the total amount of adverse effects from our fisheries has declined quite substantially since the mid-90s. The SASE analysis, I think it's in this FAQ document, but we're basically using fishing effort data from 1996 through last year. And so over that time, we've seen quite a substantial decline in adverse effects overall, and that basically is a result of less fishing effort in general. And so what we're going forward and hopefully going to bring to you in a couple months with our proposed alternatives for phase two is going to be, the attempt is to optimize the spatial distribution of where those adverse effects are occurring in our model domain and in the council's area of management. So just kind of a to point out that there's, you know, going to be a lot of uncertainty in what we're doing, and we've tried to document in the model documents as well as possible what the uncertainties are and the issues with some of the data and things like that. But, you know, just to make it clear to everybody that we're going to be moving forward and coming up with a suite of alternatives kind of in the face of not knowing everything about how fish use habitat and exactly what makes habitats vulnerable and exactly where different types of habitats are. And so just to kind of throw that out there. And obviously the SASE model is, I think, a better decision-making tool than what we've used for EFH impacts analysis in the past, but it's certainly not going to replace anybody's judgment. There's going to be a lot of additional information that we can bring in and layer on top of the SASE outputs, certainly. And then just finally, to kind of recap on the timeline that we're looking at for this action, later this month or early next month, we're hoping to have a PDT meeting to go through our the results of the analyses we're doing in response to the committee's tasking from earlier this month. And so that's going to include the SASE information, any information about corals, looking at the HAPCs, working on those practicability, the value to adverse effect metrics, and develop the recommendations to the extent that we can in that time frame. And then at some point in June, we're going to have another committee meeting that perhaps might be another joint meeting with the advisors, I'm not sure, to develop a list of alternatives and bring those to the council for the June meeting. And then assuming that we get everything on the table and include everything in the draft document at that point, we'd spend the summer refining those alternatives and analyzing them more carefully and then select preferred alternatives in September or possibly in November, I would think. So that's all that I have. So if anyone has any questions, please.
Thanks, Michelle. I just want to point out one thing. Your slide 11, criteria for HAPCs from the EFH final rule. Number three. I think it's really important that you, I'm glad you stopped at that point and really drew the attention of the council to the fact that one of the values of an HAPC is for non-fishing threats to certain areas. I'm probably not going to do a good job of articulating why I think that's very important right now, and I think as my thinking evolves and as things like the executive order and other issues or movements go on outside of this council, I think we really need to stay focused on that element of the criteria, because I think there is an important role for this body to play in protecting or safeguarding the important areas under our management so that we can continue to benefit from those protections for our fisheries. So there are stresses and threats that will be coming to sensitive bottom or otherwise important fisheries areas that we should really consider beyond or not exclusive to what types of fishing we allow or don't allow in a certain area. We need to think beyond that and think to all the other different uses that could occur in these areas. So I appreciate you bringing that up, and hopefully I'll do a better job of articulating why I think we need to consider that as we have future meetings. I just want to also go to committee motion number 5, which was slide number 12. In existing or potential closed areas, provide the committee with an analysis of metrics to characterize the trade-offs between habitat impacts and fisheries benefits. You could also rewrite that to say between habitat benefits and fisheries impacts. Right? I mean, that's not what it says here. But so I was reading that, and I was at the meeting, and I'm thinking, well, what are these metrics? And here we go with the dollar sign in the bird in the hand today versus something that's much more difficult to quantify or to have faith in, projections, long-term forecasts on the value of that particular piece of bottom to species X, Y, or Z. So I'm just trying to figure out what is the product from this motion going to look like. When you and the rest of the PDT go out and try to accomplish or meet the request of this motion, what do you envision bringing back to the committee to consider? What does it look like? Is it simply just a series of numbers with 4.3 and 6.6, and it's an obvious decision because we're comparing dollars to potential future benefits of an area.
I'm wondering if Chad wants to be thrown under the bus because he may have given this kind of more careful thought than I have at this point. Well, it looks like he does. Good. Great. Okay. I'll let Chad speak to this because he's
on the orange team as
well. He's also our PDT economist, so perhaps.
Is that a PDT requirement? We
are the orange team.
Step forward and get run over.
No, this is a critical question, isn't it? The thinking here is that there is an opportunity cost associated with every closure, right? If you displace effort from one area, you are increasing effort in another area. And we haven't really done we haven't had the ability to analyze that opportunity cost in the past, and we're starting to get closer to that. If one particular area provides, according to all of the assumptions that underlie this model, the same level of habitat protection, that is, it accumulates the same amount of adverse effects or accumulates at the same rate, but is capable of providing a much higher economic benefit to a particular fishery, then that's part of the trade-off that the council and the committee and the public probably ought to be aware of. So, yes, we will probably be having some numbers, and all of these numbers are conditioned with more caveats and assumptions and, you know, asterisks and, you know, gray them out and I promise not to put like three decimal places behind any of them. But it is important to understand at least the direction and relative magnitude of some of these trade-offs. So that's the kind of information that we're going to try to provide you with.
I note the motion says closed areas. Does that include current mortality closures?
Well, I would think so. I think that if we're going to try to, ultimately this is going to be the council's call and not ours, but if we're tasked with providing a suite of alternative closures or even alternative areas that have differential gear modifications, you could expand the 12-inch roller gear area or something like that. It's logical to think that there would be some quid pro quo and that there would be some opening of areas. So we're not going to, it would be, I think, difficult to create a need for increasing the total amount of area closures for habitat simply because the quantity of adverse effects, the amount of bottom that has touched the bottom, the amount of gear that's touched the bottom in 2009 is so much less than it was in 1996. So expanding the total amount of area closure would be a tough argument to make, I think. But redistributing those areas so that you can potentially cover areas that are more vulnerable to particular fishing gears might require opening up current closures, and that might include the groundfish closures and not just the habitat closures.
So based on that comment, is it the opinion of the PDT that the baseline from which we're evaluating things is 1996?
Not at all, but that's a very difficult question. One potential baseline that's a little bit more obvious would be the Sustainable Fisheries Act, right, when the EFH requirements came into existence. One of my projects is going to go back to the weigh-out data pre-VTR and see if we can try to get a magnitude on the adverse effect before we have VTR data. But I'm not sure how useful that's actually going to be because they're two different data sources. The 96 is simply the beginning of our good data.
Paul Howard.
Ed, Chad, the business about looking at the habitat benefits or the overall benefits of a groundfish closed area, I guess I'm concerned with is the habitat PDT going to look at this trade-off and evaluate the trade-off built on groundfish protection versus habitat protection without the PDT? And wouldn't it be better if the groundfish PDT looked at what the habitat committee protected for habitat, and then they say, oh, look, we've got all this area protected for habitat. We don't need any rebuilding protection for groundfish. That seems to me the way to go. Otherwise, you need the PDT resources to evaluate all the groundfish impacts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anybody in our PDT would feel competent or even would want to try to take a stab at the benefits to rebuilding from the current groundfish closures. And that's not to be kind of too parochial, but that's not really our role. I think it would probably be more of a – I'm not sure how this would work. This seems like a little bit of new ground. But perhaps we refer to the groundfish committee and the scallop committee recommendations and get feedback back from them.
Obviously, the second phase, a big component of the second phase of this amendment is going to contain a lot of visual aids, right? Eventually, a lot of this is going to be translated into maps with different levels of detail, and you know, it's a GIS exercise, right? So, and then it appears that a lot of the maps are going to contain certain vulnerability levels or shading. Am I right? And it also seems, in reading a lot of the documents through the development of this amendment, the trade-offs between dollars and habitat function is prevalent constantly. Would it not be beneficial to also have maps that show dollar value per 10-minute square? If you were just to aggregate all the fisheries and just assign a monetary value on an annual basis or a five-year basis? Just a question.
Yeah, that's that happens to be what I've spent the last 4.5 weeks working on. And, yes, we will be able to provide that. It's tricky. There's current groundfish closures, current year-round closures that we don't have any revenue for since 1994 and 1998 and whenever the areas were closed. So there's going to be some assumptions that go into that. But, yes, we'll be able to provide the committee and the council and the public with that kind of information.
I'll open it up. Anyone else? Dr. Pierce.
Hey, Chad. Thank you, Michelle. Appreciate the presentation, also the questions and answers related to the SASE model, swept area seabed impact model. I have to keep repeating that so I don't forget what it means, swept area seabed impact model. Very helpful. Thank you. And I'm still, even after all these months, trying to keep up the speed and understand the model itself, all the assumptions that go into it. And I've had conversations with a number of members of the group to try to, again, work my way through the forest. But I always come back, unfortunately, to one of the points made in your presentation, Michelle, which is on page 3 under research areas, where we're still faced with the real world and the fact that the nature of most gear effect studies is inconclusive, and the model has highlighted very broad uncertainties. So that still plagues me. What else is new? That you're working with it as best you can, and I congratulate you for getting as far as you have. Now, with that said, a few months ago, maybe the last council meeting, we received a presentation from the SSC regarding their examination of the model itself. And they had quite an interesting critique, favorable. They gave a lot of praise to the SSC, a lot of praise to the plan development team for work accomplished. However, they did note in their document, which goes back to January 27, from Steve Cadran to Paul Howard, they did note that the model has several limitations, and they indicated that when applying the method, those limitations really needed to be very well described and somehow handled. I'm not going to go into the specifics except to say that their critique was compelling and their recommendations seemed to be right on target. So to what extent has the Habitat Plan Development Team reflected on those particular findings and recommendations of the SSC. Have you been able to address those specific issues and recommendations in a way that makes you feel comfortable that the SSC is not going to come back afterwards and say you still haven't done what needs to be done based on our evaluation?
Thanks, Dave. I think that the kind of limitations and assumptions inherent in the model have been clear to the team for a long time, and hopefully we've documented those well. Where I see kind of implementing their recommendations is once we get to the stage of looking at particular areas, then we kind of, depending on either what deer type we're thinking about or what we know about the area or what we know that we really don't know very well about the area, I think each alternative proposed would get some discussion about, you know, what the uncertainties are and what the caveats are in interpreting the model outputs for that region in particular. I don't know if you have anything to add to that, but so it would be kind of a more ad hoc area by area thing once we've done kind of a first cut analysis.
Okay, so clearly from what you said, you two leaders of the initiative are continuing to pay close attention to what the SSC did conclude and recommend. And in your leadership roles, you'll still focus on those particular points. One reason why I asked the question was as a consequence of my taking a look at the habitat PDT summary of February 22nd and 23rd, where there is a paragraph that's specific to the SSC review. And after I read that, it seemed like at least one plan development team member, maybe more, were downplaying the importance or significance of those particular conclusions and recommendations. I hope that wasn't the case. The language is such that it seems to be minimizing the SSC, significance of the SSC critique, and I assume that's not correct.
The issue that we were focusing on in particular at that meeting was the SSC had a concern about kind of the relative certainty, I think, with which you could calculate an area swept for mobile gears versus an area swept for fixed gears. And it's been clear to the PDT since we tried to start calculating an area swept for fixed gears that there's just a huge amount of uncertainty in that process. Nobody's done it before. So comparing between those two gear types is, I mean, we can get a sense for the relative magnitude of the difference, but there's a lot of fuzziness in those numbers. So I think that the team members that were kind of downplaying the SSC's concerns, my sense was that it was more specific to that issue. I mean, obviously, going forward and presenting the results in a way that's useful to the committee and useful to the council, but is, you know, doesn't make too much out of them and it retains kind of our uncertainty about the different outputs is going to be key. But I think, you know, in regards to the difference between the fixed and mobile gear area swept, it's very difficult to make
those. It's also the simulation maps.
The
one big, in our opinion anyway, the biggest problem that the SSC had was the inability to take the simulation maps and compare the numbers across the different gear types. And that was because I had taken 100 average tows and 100 average strings of traps and 100 average gill nets and put them into the simulation run. That was a silly idea, and Michelle actually was the one that pointed out the more proper solution to that, which is just to obliterate all that and assume that you were putting 100 square kilometers of area swept for every gear type into every cell. Even if that means that that's 10 million traps, so what? It's a simulation run. It's just supposed to reveal the vulnerability of particular areas of real estate. So now when we took the simulation runs to the committee at our last committee meeting, those are comparable across gear types in not only distribution but in magnitude. And that was in direct response to that comment, that one comment that was a very critical comment that the SSC made.
One final point. As long as the plan development team continues to communicate with the SSC to keep the SSC up to speed as to what you're doing, how you're responding to their comments, I'll feel comfortable. I noticed in the, again, that one-page summary of the review, it concludes by saying that the staff and the team will make their best attempts to communicate with the SSC, et cetera, et cetera. Don't make your best attempts. Just make sure it's done, and we don't come back later on, the council, that is, to hear, and after the fact, critique of all the hard work that you're doing that might not be as favorable as it otherwise would be because of the lack of communication. Just that's my emphasis. Just keep communicating with that SSC so we can all feel that, you know, we don't have to go back to some square one or square 10 out of square 1,000. So, thanks.
Just point out briefly that our SSC liaison to Habitat is here, so I think we're all.
He's been a part of everything.
He's been paying attention, yeah. So.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Prebble?
Yeah, thank you. In response to that, one of the things that we decided right up front in the very first SSC contact, in fact, Chad called me on the phone and said, what do you think? How close should we be to them? And I said, so close that you can smell one another's breath. I think the PDT and the SSC have to stay in very close contact on this, obviously. And also, just salient point is that the structure of the SASE model flows directly from the legal mandate. It was determined by the legal mandate. That's where it came from. That's how the structure was determined. So it should be adapted to fulfilling our legal responsibilities under Magnuson. The other thing is that was brought up that I want to also emphasize is that. We have had an enormous reduction in adverse effects because of the decline in fishing over the last couple of decades. And so the council, one decision that SASE is not going to be able to help with is the decision as to just how much more reduction of adverse effect we need to put into effect in order to fulfill our legal obligations and our moral obligations as well. And then SASE will help us with the spatial distribution of how those are accomplished. The coral question, there's within the last couple of days, the NOAA released a strategic plan for deep sea coral and sponge ecosystems. It's dated March 2010, but we just received it within the last couple of days. So the guidance that Michelle said we needed is apparently here. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but apparently now we have the guidance we need to make some of the decisions on corals. In regard to what Paul was talking about with the MSPs and the and I'd like to extend that to the ecosystem management plan, SASE is particularly adapted to keeping us ahead of that curve. Marine spatial planning, I think, as we've already seen, has the potential to be a big threat to New England fisheries anyway. And I think that the SASE model, being able to come up with some usable data, has come at a particularly propitious time. I'd like to say we planned it that way, but it's just dumb luck. And I'd like to end my part of this by saying that as far as our approach to MSP is concerned, about a week ago, Chris Brown called me, and he had been thinking. I hate it when he thinks because he comes up with these weird things. He said it is evident to him from something he read that right now, since chicken is now the number one source of protein for American citizens, that we lie right now one avian flu pandemic from a protein crisis in the country. And he said, bearing that in mind, he said, perhaps when we start looking at marine spatial planning, we should designate these areas offshore as being marine protein reserves and that they should be held in such reserve as a question of national security. I don't know how many beers that he consumed before that came up, but it's an interesting idea. At first I laughed. I thought he was kidding. And the more I thought about it, it's indicative of where we have to go. We have to be proactive. We have to think of ways of addressing this marine spatial planning threat, and in a way that's going to work for us. And I think that the SASE model and the whole process can do that. And now we've got SASE as a usable tool. It's now functional, and it's time to move on, develop the alternatives, get this this amendment completed and into effect. And that's the crossroads we're at right now, and that's the direction that we have to take. With that, I'm done.
Okay, that's it, Dave? Michelle? Team Orange? You guys are good? All right, next time, blue. Blue shirts. Anything else from the council? I see Ron, you have your hand up. Come on down, Ron. We're on schedule, Ron, so let's stay that way.
Yeah. Ron Smallwoods, Fishery Survival Fund. I won't go into a long litany. The point that I'm concerned about is something that I think Paul Howard alluded to, which is from an ecosystem approach, from this point forward where we're starting to define our habitat and impacts to habitat, I really think that it has to go back to the plant, the individual fishery management plan teams to develop the strategies. And just one example, the boundary question that you brought up. If we're going to be controlling groundfish now with actual output controls, then the only legitimate reason for those boundaries for the three fixed groundfish areas on Georges become issues relative to habitat. And unless there's some other groundfish issues. So it would seem to me the logical approach would be for the groundfish PDT to examine the issue of those boundary lines and maybe propose an alternative that could then be analyzed from the habitat PDT perspective using this SASE model, because only the groundfish team is going to know about the impacts and shifts in effort on different species and the whole nine yards. From a scallop standpoint, similar, if in fact the groundfish boundaries are removed, it should be the scallop committee and scallop PDT that come up with proposed scallop access rotation areas, and then that, looking at the overall all the scallop picture, options could then be, alternatives could then be given to the Habitat Committee, PDT, for analysis as far as the weighing the different options from a habitat standpoint. But I do not think that the Habitat PDT has the expertise to deal with all the other issues relative to fisheries management, that shifting effort and access area boundaries and rotational strategies imply. And I don't think we have to wait for the completion of this this habitat omnibus amendment to start utilizing this tool to look at the scallop and groundfish questions. Thank you.
Dave Allison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dave Allison from Oceana. I just wanted to emphasize one of the things that was up on the slide for an extended period of time, and that is that this isn't just a good idea. It's a mandate of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. This is now 5 years overdue. This action is now 5 years overdue. The idea of extending this for another 3 years while new management actions are investigated and analyzed does not seem like a reasonable approach to fulfilling the mandates of the Act. So I would just encourage you to proceed expeditiously with this. I'm not a scientist, so I didn't do the kind of in-depth analysis that Mr. Pierce was talking about, but I have been working with several other councils on ecosystem amendment development, And I can say that this SASE effort probably is one of the best foundations that I've seen for a council to move with the requirements for moving toward ecosystem management. And I think everybody who's been involved with this, including the council that has kept it on the burner for so long, can take a great deal of pride in that. So again, I just would encourage you to use this tool that your team has put together to effectively move as expeditiously as possible to complete the EFH and HAPSE provisions and to protect the deep-sea corals using these reasonable management approaches and recognizing the importance of the precautionary approach. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Back to the council. Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you. Just one quick thing. I think that given the fact that that we should be looking not at closed areas but at gear-restricted areas, I think that Michelle made a superb point with that, by the way, gear-restricted areas, because not all gear types are going to impact an area the same way. I think that that also addresses Ron's point. I think Ron made a very valid point. I would hope that, that our alternatives are couched in such a way that, that it can become an omnibus amendment that then will guide each individual fishery management plan in making specific decisions on closures that are appropriate to that plan. That's what I envision anyway, and I think that's how it's going to work out.
Okay. So that concludes Habitat. We're going to move right into Monkfish. Terry?
Okay, folks, if you can refer to your binder behind tab 10, and for the folks in the audience at the table, there are three documents. The first is the Amendment 5 decision document, which is 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 5 decision document, which